Hello and welcome to another episode of the Vinyl Countdown, the podcast where I, Jeremy Levine, break down my favorite vinyl releases from cover to cover and everything in between. On this week's first episode of the October Spooktacular for this year, the third annual already. It's been 3 years I've been doing this. It's great. I had the pleasure of sitting down and speaking with Martin McPhail, one-third of the trio that is Blitz Berlin, who make awesome instrumental music, but also score a lot of movies and movie trailers and things of that nature. And, again, one-third of the group who did the score for Psycho Goreman, which is why you're here, I'm sure. This movie is, if you haven't seen it, it's absolutely insane, in a good way. I wouldn't say campy, but it is very kind of over the top, gory, it's funny, it's scary, it's a lot of attention and detail was, I think, brought to it with the idea of making it like an homage to the, I guess, like your 90s, like early 90s, like real just weird sci-fi horror comedy sort of things. And, you know, the cast is great, the comedic timing is wonderful, the music is also awesome, of course. There's a lot to like about the movie. So if you like anything at all in the horror, comedy, sci-fi, or a mix of all the three, then I think you'd really enjoy Psycho Goreman. With that said, I wanted to get down into Variant Corner really quick and talk about the one vinyl release that is available now. So let's go on down to Variant Corner. All right, so there is one released by, of course, the in my opinion, the absolute best score, horror, not just horror, but, you know, primarily horror, movie score, vinyl releasing company, Waxwork, who I finally looked into it and saw how many releases I have by them, and it's like 17 with like maybe two or three on the way. So yeah, they're awesome. And I did, you know, my thoughts are going out to them. Their families, their facility, their livelihood has been uprooted due to Hurricane Ida, which really sucks. As we all know here in my area, last year we got absolutely destroyed by Hurricane Laura. It's shitty and it sucks to have to live through that. But I did see an email today sent out that while they are spread out, they're kind of just scattered everywhere, everybody is okay. So that's the most important thing, right? Like, everybody made it out good. And, you know, I know they'll come back strong and just as good as ever, but it's, you know, thoughts going out to them, and it really fucking sucks. But so this record, it was, like I said, I think it's only one pressing on vinyl. It's a blue, almost like a sky blue, translucent cover, color with a very light pink splatter, and it looks awesome. It's very, kind of neon era colors, like, you know what I mean? It's kind of that sort of that vibe. The artwork is also pretty great. There's an insert with PG ripping someone in half, which is also cool. There's the council. I don't know. I always want to say the Council of Elders, but I don't know that they have like an official like name like that. It's just like this Galactic Council or whatever. If you watch the movie, you'll get it. Very Power Rangers-y vibes there. There's, you know, pictures of that. It all is, as always, Waxwork, they do an incredible job with their artwork, with their packaging. The records themselves always sound great. So, I mean, if you have any other Waxwork release, then you know what to expect, and you will not be disappointed by this one. As of the last time I checked, I think it might be sold out by now. There are a few on Discogs here selling for anywhere from $30 to $35, and two people trying to sell them for $85 to $90, which, you know, I think that's more wishful thinking. But a quick check on the website here, and I believe it is sold out. But, you know, like I said, you can go to eBay or, oh no, actually, sorry, scratch all that, it is not sold out, so you can still get it for retail if you want it. So would definitely say to pick it up because it's awesome, and watch the movie, and then also, I guess, with all that being said, enjoy the interview, and then I'll be back after to wrap everything up. So here it is. All right, so this is Jeremy Levine. I'm here with Martin from Blitz Berlin, and today we'll be discussing just Blitz Berlin's career in general, and also Psycho Goreman, of course, is why a lot of you are here, given the title of the episode, we'll be talking about that. So, Martin, how are you doing today?
Good, Jeremy. How are you, man? I'm good. I'm tired, but I'm here. It's been a long week of work and other things, and kind of finally get to wind down for a long weekend, you know?
I unfortunately they don't have like a whole lot of meaning in my world. My girlfriend is very hyped on that. She works like a real person job. But weekends, they all just, yeah. When you do this kind of work, especially because a lot of the time our projects end up being due on Mondays, it's like weekends are sometimes our busiest time. So, but I think Labor Day is one of the ones that even Hollywood kind of just like everybody takes off. So maybe I will get some time off this one.
That kind of reminds me when I got older and got a job, and I realized it's you don't get out for the summer, right? Like school's like, hey, you're out for the summer, great. And it's like, oh wait, summers don't exist anymore. I have a job.
Yeah, so this is the thing. A few of my friends who I went to school with like stuck with education and now have their PhDs, and a lot of them who have gone into teaching positions, they still get to live that life. Like not fully, because you have to do some prep and you can teach summer courses, but you can also make it so you just get like 4 months a year off basically. You're off from like, you know, May to September.
That's a pretty sweet gig.
Right? Like that's the big upside. There's a lot of downsides to working in education, but you still get summer vacation, which is nice, I guess.
That is a pretty good perk. And like you said, there's quite a few downsides, but there is some upside.
Definitely.
So walk the I guess walk the listeners through the kind of the inception of the band. What was the idea going in? Like I know you guys are an instrumental band. Was that how you always kind of wanted to be, or was there ever a time where like you were like, man, let's add a vocalist, or was it always going to be the way it is now?
Yeah, I mean, so myself and Dean and Tristan, the three members of Blitz Berlin, we met just after high school. Dean and Tristan actually know each other since like playing t-ball together in like grade three. So we've all known
Wow.
each other for a long time. And we started like a post-hardcore emo band after high school called The Set, and which I was the vocalist in, and Dean played bass, Tristan played drums. We had some great guitar players, and we would, you know, tour North America and play every bar you've never heard of for like $100 a night,
Yeah.
which we did for many years before getting our first record deal and moving to Toronto. And around that time is when the guitar players left the band. Things didn't go all that well with our first record deal. Same old story, you know. And basically, we entered sort of this period of like confusion artistically, where we were wanting to still make music, but our sort of childhood dream of this being in a popular, you know, rock and roll band was seeming to sort of run into the rocks. And around that time, we kind of had like a conversation, the three of us. We're like magic eight ball situation, you know. If you could ask a question and know about the future, like if we know that we'll just like never ever make money from music, well, it'll never be like a real job, do we still like get together and make music tomorrow? And the three of us at that time were just like, well, yeah, I mean, it's the only thing we're any good at and it's fun. When we don't do it, we all get depressed, so
Yeah.
we kind of just gotta do it. So then we're like, okay, well, if that's the case, then let's just make sort of whatever the hell we want. And we started making very strange experimental music that was not emo, didn't have vocals, you know. It was experimenting in production and recording our own stuff. And right around that time, a guy who made our or directed a few of our music videos when we were in a band got his first bit of money to make a science fiction movie and didn't like who he was paired with for music. And I got a call in the middle of the night from him that was like, he scored my fucking movie kind of thing. And I was like, no problem, totally. And then got off the phone, and literally the three of us had to sit there and like Google like how do you score a movie, essentially. We just had never done anything like that, but we're also in this phase where we were just experimenting and trying new things. We're like, well, you know, let's try. So that was a learning experience. It was a movie called Extraterrestrial, which a long time ago now. And that was sort of our first foot in the door with making movie music. We'd already been making some experimental instrumental music, but never putting it to picture. And it's something that we just kind of took to and made a lot of sense for us in the first place. I think always when we were playing in a band before, when we were writing songs, they were always written with visuals in mind, and they were always on the like a little experimental tip, I think. So this was kind of just like a license to like throw off any shackles of like format or suggestion of how you're supposed to write a song or any of these things that we, you know, were probably never all that good at that part of it, you know, the like pop aspect. When
Yeah.
it comes to making weird sounds and trying to just like create atmospheres and places, like that's what we always, I think, really love doing. So making film music, all of a sudden, we were, you know, in scenes where there's an alien invasion happening, and it's just like, well, there's not really rules to what we do here. It just has to feel like scary or exciting or whatever. And it was a very freeing experience. So we were kind of hooked at that point. And then right around that time, a lovely coincidence is our instrumental album made it into the hands of a music supervisor in Los Angeles who works in the movie trailer world, a woman named Marcy, who had become very kind of essential to our ongoing careers, heard something in what we were doing. I'm not sure how, because listening back, those demos were like not good. But she heard something, bless her for that, and wanted us to work on this movie, The Girl on the Train, to do the trailer for that, working with a Kanye West vocal and kind of working with combining one of our tracks with one of his to make this Heartless remix. And that just opened a lot of doors for us. So it was in sort of short succession, we'd made some weird instrumental music, done our first movie, done our first trailer. And it was also this glimpse at like, wait, like we just did the same amount of work we would have done for a band to make $100. And we made like more than $100. Like, but this could be a job. Holy crap. You know? So we'd all, you know, by that point been working jobs and going to school and doing other things while we still made music as a passion. But that was kind of this, it showed us this path that we didn't know existed. And we've kind of never looked back from that.
So with that being said, would you ever in the future think of like reincorporating vocals, or are you just strictly out of the vocal game at this point?
Yeah, I mean, we still, as Blitz, like we've made three instrumental records. We've made two records that do have vocals on there. It's something that we're, you know, we're happy to experiment with. I think the way that we look at vocals now, whether it's my voice or it's featured vocalists, is we kind of look at it like any other instrument. You know, we don't necessarily have violin in every single song or piano in every single song. And by the same token, not every piece of music feels like it needs vocals. However, it's something that we really like to experiment with. And when it feels right, we definitely are interested in going down that path for sure. And in our spare time, we still make rock music 100%.
Yeah.
I don't know if it'll ever see the light of day, but it's, you know, when we need to unwind from making like very like serious like movie music, we'll just, you know, get in a jam space figuratively a lot of the time and just make rock and roll because it's just kind of fun.
I can see that. It's interesting you mentioned the idea of vocals as an instrument, which is something I've always kind of thought of too. And just the other day I was talking to somebody about that and they just could not wrap their head around the concept of, it's like, what do you mean? I was like, well, I mean, if it's hard to explain, but it's like, it's just another instrument. Like you can use it how you need to, you can do whatever with it. And it's like, you don't have to, there's no set, like, here's how this vocal has to sound sort of thing, I guess. And the other person in the room that kind of agreed was like, well, yeah, you know, there's some songs where the person doesn't necessarily sing well. Like it's not like Mariah Carey or something of that, but it just sounds good with the rest of the music. You know, a lot of punk hardcore is kind of like that. They're not necessarily great singers in the classical sense, but they are good vocalists, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, I was trying to get that concept. They were just like, nope.
Yeah.
Not getting it.
I think that's absolutely the case. And it's something that's been very freeing creatively in our lives too, because I think, you know, when we were playing in a band, if Dina was going to write a part, it was just going to be on bass or on guitar. Tristan was going to contribute rhythm via drums. And if I was writing, it was going to be lyrics and vocals. And we kind of each had our role, which worked well for the chemistry in the room and was fun to write with. But in this, you know, this phase of our careers that we're now in, there's not really any ground rules to that part. So, you know, Dina might write a piece that's fully piano. I might write something that's only strings. Tristan might contribute like sampling or other types of production. There's not really a, I guess the realization that you're not shackled to the instrument you're born with or the one that you got good at is like a wonderful thing about modern recording, that you can apply your music instincts with like boundless creativity with, you know, software and synths and stuff.
Yeah. So still speaking of just music in general, so what were some of y'all's like kind of favorite bands, or like what were some influences going into from the post-hardcore world, which I know there's a ton there. That's kind of where I've always kind of lived musically, I guess. And then into instrumental music, what are some bands, I guess, in that world that you kind of like they're making cool shit, like, you know, you really like that, you know?
Yeah. I mean, when we were coming up in the punk and hardcore scene, especially, like the bands that we, I think, connected the most with were bands like At the Drive-In and the Mars Volta and Glassjaw and some of the stuff that was a little more, I mean, especially the At the Drive-In and Mars Volta stuff, you know, is pretty experimental and pretty out there. And
yeah,
and I mean, I love it. And I remember the first time hearing the first Volta record, and it just was, it's like what people talk about in the 70s, the first time they smoked weed and listened to Zeppelin. It felt like that moment for me where I was just like, oh, I've never heard music like this. Like, this blew my mind.
Yeah.
I've always been very inspired by those guys and that kind of stuff. And you know, as much flack as they sometimes get for their more experimental tendencies, they are a band that, you know, on their second record had like, I don't know, like a 10-minute instrumental jam in the middle of a song. Yeah. As much as I was at the time, I think as a young listener, like frustrated by this stuff, because like, I want to hear Cedric's voice. I want to hear like songs that are a little tighter. It was also kind of mind expanding because they seemed to just be throwing out the rule book in terms of what a song could be.
Yeah.
So that was always really inspiring. Probably the biggest one that I would always come back to though, is I grew up listening to so much Nine Inch Nails and worshiping, you know, the Downward Spiral and the Fragile. And so Trent and Atticus, their evolution into being award-winning, wonderful film composers, but also approaching film composition in a totally different tonal way was really inspiring for us. And that's always been, I think, something that made us believe that it was possible for guys like us to do this job. Because yeah. I think as kids, when you think of a film composer, you think of somebody like John Williams or Hans Zimmer or Elfman or any of these guys who are amazing, accomplished composers, but they also have this air of them of guys who are like handwriting, you know, sheet music and went to music school for this and are like, you know, incredible concert pianists or something. And that's certainly not the world we came from. So then seeing Trent and Atticus, who of course are incredibly talented just in different ways, score a film like The Social Network or something, still as dramatically and as beautifully as somebody else might, but using a whole different palette. And that was really inspiring for us, because that seemed kind of more like, oh, we know how to make that music a little bit. Like, there's a way forward for us there. We don't necessarily have to, you know, be able to off the top of our heads handwrite sheet music for an orchestra like that. As a, you know, me in my 20s thinking about doing something like that, it would have been so overwhelming. So
I can imagine.
Yeah.
So when scoring moves down, that's, you've kind of found your groove and like you guys have done quite a bit of it. Do you, I don't know why in my head I'm imagining like you get like a pre-advance, like a copy of the movie, you kind of have an idea of scenes or the script. And is that something, you know, like how you kind of set it up where you maybe watch through it or you read through it and go, okay, here's kind of how we want this to go, like mood or, you know, or I guess with the director too, is that something that maybe they kind of will say, hey, here in this scene, I really want this to be conveyed. And then you guys kind of go from there.
Yeah, yeah. And each director is different with the way they approach this stuff. Typically, the best way that we find to do this sort of thing is we'll get usually a rough cut of the film, so we can watch it through. And a lot of times directors will cut with temp music. So they'll have, you know, all of their favorite films they'll have pulled some score from to just like make the scenes kind of work a little bit. So we'll get an idea of what they were going for emotionally. We have had directors who sort of refuse to do that and cut without music entirely as well. It's all kind of a matter of taste. But typically there's some temp music in there that, so we watch it, we get a sense for it. We usually start writing at that point and create what we call sketchbooks for the films, which are just kind of larger pieces of music that are more like vision pieces of, here's an idea for like a character theme, or, you know, when the plot twist happens and the killer comes out or whatever, like it needs to be scary. Like, here's what we're thinking we're going to explore for that. So that we start sort of the sonic dialogue with the director at that point. And they're like, oh, I like this. Oh, I don't like this. We can go back and forth. So then by the time they have a lock cut, we'll do a spotting session. And usually they're able at that point to reference things that we've already talked about, be like, oh, this piece might work in here. Try that sort of thing. So we do a very detailed spotting session and make notes throughout the whole film. Usually spend a few hours just talking in depth with the director. And each director is different with the type of direction they'll give. Sometimes it's very specific. And sometimes it is more general, just like, I want you to feel remorse for this character, but then we have to change into like fear when this happens. It'll be more emotional conversations. Sometimes it's more precise than that in terms of the timing of scares and things like that too. So yeah, it's a lot of listening really on our end, and contributing music, but then really listening to what a director is saying. And something that's great, what I'm very thankful for having Dean and Tristan as well, is if the three of us are on and we're all taking notes, the three of us will then discuss afterwards, and we all sort of like focused on and caught different things. So I think between the three of us, we have maybe a more in-depth understanding than only I would if I was on that call, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then at that point, we start working on the film. So between our sketchbooks, between the conversations and our detailed spotting notes, we kind of have like a roadmap based on our music for generally what we're going to do with the film. And then at that point, we just start writing.
So with Psycho Goreman, with it, with it being so, I don't want to say campy. It is sort of campy. Like, it's kind of a throwback to those 80s, you know, just real over the top gory, but also funny. And like, it is a little spooky in spots, you know. I saw somebody describe it as if E.T. starred Pinhead, which is like, yeah, sure, I'll take that.
Yeah, totally.
I'm assuming it was fairly intentional to kind of have like this like synthy score, and like, you know, it's very like, again, like throwback to like these 80s, 90s kind of campy, just gore fests, right?
Definitely.
Of all the movies you've done, like, what's probably like your favorite, like, you know, from a score perspective, but also just from like a watching, like, holy shit, that movie's awesome perspective.
I'm really not blowing smoke here, given the topic of this interview, but it probably in a lot of ways is Psycho Goreman, because like, yeah, I'm very proud of a lot of the films that we've done, and we've had the pleasure of working with a lot of really great directors that we hope to continue working with in the future. But PG is such a singular film in the way that it executes its topic. And it's also the first time we've ever done anything that could be really like defined as a comedy. Most of the stuff we've done is pretty self-serious. So that was a real treat on a lot of levels. But also working with Steve, the director, on this, the way that he thinks about music is unique, because while he was creating something like Psycho Goreman, as much as he had a very clear vision in his mind of what it is, he also has a very clear vision of what it's not, which is almost as important when you're doing something that has this like send up sort of camp vibe that you mentioned. Because one of the things he identified right off the bat is, he's like, you know, the nostalgia thing is very popular right now, people throwing back to these eras of childhood and revisiting these things. But I got to be clear, like, this is not Stranger Things. That's not what we're doing here. Like, that's a different thing that they're referencing, and they do it very well, but like, that's not our thing. Like, very specifically, PG is existing in like a few years of the early 90s. It's not even the 80s, really. You know, it's like the era basically between like 90 and I guess like 93 is kind of it when it comes to, you know, the original Ninja Turtles movie was a big reference for sure. Ninja Turtles movie. And the Power Rangers TV show and some of the Saturday morning cartoons and stuff, you know, and which is great for us because that's legit the shit that we grew up on. So there wasn't a whole lot of like homework to be done on our end.
Yeah.
Mentioned the Ninja Turtles movie, then he and I would just be going back and forth with like quotes or talking about scenes, because I watched that movie like every weekend as a kid. So it was an interesting musical experiment, because the way that he was definitely not a micromanager, very much let us write and create and build these pieces for him. But then his comments were really interesting when it came to refining them, because instead of being like talking emotionally necessarily, it would be like, oh, this is cool, except it's playing it a little too serious. Like, this needs to be a little more like, let's lean more into like John Williams. Let's feel a little more Star Wars with this part, you know? And then with this moment, like, oh, I love this, but like, we need to go even smaller with it, because what's happening on screen is so big and it'll play against it. Like, he has a very, very good natural sense of what's funny, why it's funny, kind of for his film. So he was very hands-on with the score, but also in like a way that was inspiring to work with.
I think
directors being hands-on can sometimes, you know, have a negative connotation as a micromanager. No, play this note. No, do this. And he never did that. But it was more that he had a very specific sense of taste when it came to what the score will accomplish with what was on screen, for sure.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned Power Rangers. That was literally the first thing I thought of, with like the Galactic Council or whatever. Like, it looks just like a weird like unused like a Power Rangers sketch or something like that. Like, it took me way back. I was like, holy shit.
Yeah, it's funny actually, that scene specifically, the Galactic Council, Steve referred to it as his Attack of the Clones scene, because there is a scene in like the second Star Wars prequel where it does just cut away to a bunch of aliens you've never seen before around a council talking about the Jedi, and you're like, who are these guys? And so he wanted, I think the idea was like, we're gonna have a similar plot jump here where you're like, you don't know who any of these people are, we're just gonna throw you into this world and explain nothing. And it you know, has that kind of wonderful comedy to it.
Yeah, I had a big chuckle about it. I watched it with my son, who he's 10, which, you know, it's kind of gory, but it's like, I watched God knows what at an earlier age, so growing up with like Child's Play and, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street, all that kind of stuff. So it's like, I was like, you know what? I think you're fine. We could probably watch it. There's gonna be some head ripping or whatever, but it's fine. And I busted out laughing that scene. He kind of just didn't get it. He was just like, I don't get why that's funny. It's like, it's a whole thing. I'll explain it.
It's a funny thing, right? As kids, like watching, I've thought about this a fair amount. And while we were working on PG too, as when you're watching things as a kid, you take things at face value. So like things like irony are sort of hard to get when you're young, because everything, if you're seeing it for the first time, you're kind of just like, okay, there's like a galactic council. Cool. I'm going to roll with this. And only as an adult, you're like, no, that's not how you're supposed to do it. You know? But yeah, no, did he enjoy it? Did your son like it?
He loved it. He thought it was great. The scenes of like the head ripping was done. It was initially kind of spooky, like, oh, this big monster. But then when he kills people, and it's just like, it's really over the top. And it's like almost cartoony. And that's, you know, it's kind of, okay, it's really, they're having a lot of fun with it, you can tell, you know. And then, of course, the scenes of Mimi talking to him, and he's real just like, I'm going to kill you. And she has a stone, and he's like, oh.
Yeah.
It's like, then they kind of broke the tension. Because initially he was like, oh, man, that's a big monster. Then it's like, oh, wait a minute, he's kind of a big baby because he can't do anything.
I think that's great. Steve did such a good job writing PG with like as a character with that stuff, where I think you like legitimately kind of end up feeling for him, even though he's like a super safe monster, you know. You're kind of for him to like find his way in life.
Yeah, you kind of I don't want to say identify with him, but yeah, there's a way to, it's like, man, you know, I just want him to do okay, you know. He might go off and kill another world, maybe, who knows. That's kind of the fun thing. And then of course, you know, I still watch it probably every other day or so. I'll just watch the hunky boy scene, which is just, the first time I think I watched it, I was kind of doing something else, and I was paying attention, but not really. And I was kind of doing whatever. And I think I wanted to preview it before I watched it with my son. And so the second time we actually sat and I really watched it. And I guess I had missed that part somehow. And it comes up and he does the whole thing. And I just like, I'm dying laughing. But my wife's laughing. She doesn't even really care for this kind of stuff. And it's just like, yeah, so that's kind of become a whole thing in the house. You know, we talk about hunky boys now. It's just, it's so great.
I love that. That is, man, I tell you, when I first got the script for this film, I was reading it on an airplane on my way back to Los Angeles, and was like biting down on my hand with tears in my eyes reading it. Like on the page, it's every bit as funny. And it's like the hunky boys gag. Like, I think I like yelled, like laughing, you know. it's so well written. And he just, pulled it off very well.
Like the timing is perfect. And then of course it gets referenced later. It's, you know, the whole big fight, like, hunky boy. Like, it's so good. I don't know. That's one of those things. I feel like it's like, if nothing else, if you're trying to get somebody to watch the movie, like I've been showing that clip to people, like, you'll get more of this, please watch the movie. But this is like the best part. So the movie with Psycho Goreman, again, it's more of a kind of a horror comedy. So it's like the first sort of comedic take y'all have done. That being said, like, do you prefer to work in like a sci-fi horror world, or does it kind of just seem to go that way?
Yeah, I mean, I think that a little of both. I think that that sort of stuff is what we love to watch. It's what we really, especially science fiction, is what we're, you know, just super interested in. We all grew up on Star Wars and Star Trek, and you know, later on in life, the Battlestar Galactica, or, you know, more recently, The Expanse, things like this are just like really my favorite stuff to watch. I really love that. So I think that comes across in the music we make naturally. You know, it falls into this like sort of darker world. So I think it's a bit of both. We really like that stuff. Therefore, we make music that sounds like it should be in it. And therefore, those directors find us. They're like, it sounds like you're already scoring my movie, which we're very happy about. It's led us to work on some films that I think I would have loved as a fan, even if we hadn't worked on. So I feel very lucky for that.
That's cool. So before I get off the movie topic, I wanted to switch over briefly to vinyl records in general and your feelings on those. Are you like a vinyl collector at all? Do you get into it, or are you sort of just kind of, you know, I know it's been a huge rise in like the past probably 10, 15 years. Yeah. I've been collecting since like 2008 or so. And even from then to now, it's a huge boom, you know. So is that something that you guys have kind of always been into, or do you get into it at all?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I've been into for a long time. It's something, you know, my dad had a bunch of vinyls growing up around the house, and they were all, you know, they're probably collector's items now. You know, they were like original, you know, Hendrix and Zeppelin and old rock and roll and punk rock and The Clash and all the stuff. And those are the records I just grew up putting on in the house and really loving. He actually hand built the speakers for his system and stuff too, so it was like a very boutique-y sort of setup, and it sounded great. So later in life, I've always really liked vinyls. I wouldn't say I'm like a, I know some people are so knowledgeable and collect such a massive have such a massive collection. I'm not that fanatic about it necessarily, but I definitely have a lot of records, and especially really sort of like special releases of things I really like. The most recent two that I've got are the new Godspeed You Black Emperor, which nice. They released during the pandemic, which is really cool and uses a lot of like radio signals that they sampled directly from like during the pandemic and stuff, and a record by an artist named Morley, which I bought, who features on one of our albums, and it's her new record is wonderful. So yeah, I've got a bunch of records. I think for me, the interest in vinyl actually came about probably about 10 years ago when I was working for a record label at the time. And one of our artists, an indie rock band, really, really wanted to do a vinyl. And that was the first time I was ever on like the pressing side of it, where like I had to coordinate with like the pressing plant and the artists and all this stuff. And they really wanted, you know, this special like transparent blue, 180 gram, had to be gatefold, had to be full color, every part of it, you know, all that stuff. But going through that process and then getting one and then putting it on at home and it sounding so good, I kind of just like had a bit more of an understanding of like how these things are made. And ever since then, you know, it just becomes a bit of a weekend activity to just like take a walk through a record store, you know, pandemic allowing.
Yeah, that's one thing. The first time I ever really got into the production side of vinyl and looking how they're made, and especially splatters and other things, and like wax mages, like those are insane. Mm-hmm. That's something that I guess I didn't realize how involved the process was. And it really kind of makes me appreciate the ones that I have even more. You know, as I look at them, I'm like, God damn, somebody put a lot of work into this.
Totally. Yeah. You know, absolutely. It's something that I'm very happy with Waxwork, the guys who did the PG vinyl, that they definitely take like an extra step of care, and hiring Vance Kelly for artwork and the art that for the whole package is amazing. But also like, you know, they could have done all that stuff and then done like a normal colored vinyl or something, but like they, every step of the way, they've gone the extra step to make it like a very special item, which I really appreciate.
Yeah. That, I don't think I've been let down with the Waxwork release yet. And I think I've probably got nearly 20 of the releases, I guess. Nice. And, it's just, which I guess side note, it kind of sucks for them. I got an email this morning that I know they got hit with the Hurricane Ida recently, and, everybody's safe, but it's kind of like in disarray and everything. And really kind of sucks. New Orleans got hit pretty much directly.
Did it ever? Yeah, there's the videos from there are just insane. And yeah, I mean the main people that I would know personally from there are the Waxwork guys. That was my first thought. You know, obviously there's so much destruction and stuff down there. I'm very glad that team is safe and healthy.
Yeah, it's the one thing about living down here, we have to worry about heat and hurricanes. So it's like, you know, it's a yearly thing.
That's a bad combo. Yeah, that's a lot for sure.
Yeah, good old Louisiana. So
everywhere's got something though, man. Honestly, like I was just out in BC where I grew up, in British Columbia on the west coast of Canada. And that's a place that is just like kind of constantly on fire now. You know, there's the global catastrophes will find you one way or another, it seems.
So my brother actually moved to California a few years ago, and he left from here with all the heat and the hurricanes and all that to go to like a moderate climate, but then fires. And, you know, just earthquakes, whatever it might be.
yeah, it's going to be something. It's going to be something. You just got to kind of like, it's like a choose your own disaster sort of situation, you know?
Pretty much. But it seems like it, despite the insane cost of living and other, you know, different natural disasters. He's like, oh, it's way better than Louisiana. It's like, it probably is.
Yeah, that's good. Maybe he's found his spot.
Yeah. But so before we get out of here, I did want to ask you if you can speak about anything. What are some upcoming projects, either with the band or with movies, trailers? Mm-hmm. Do they have anything in the works that's coming up that we should be looking out for?
Yeah, we've got a bunch of stuff on the go. Trailer stuff is always the most locked down stuff, so I can't really talk about that. But
yeah,
there's hopefully, I mean, it's also one of those things where I don't want to talk about it even if I could, because there's always 10 things that sound so exciting and like maybe one will happen. Yeah, trailers is the Wild West. We got a bunch of stuff in trailers. I don't know. But stuff I can talk about is, well, actually, yesterday, the most recent film we scored called Superhost just came out on Shudder.
Oh, nice.
So that's out now. And it's like a Airbnb horror movie, basically, but it's got some fantastic performances. And the director, Brandon, is a big David Fincher fan and a big Nine Inch Nails fan. So it was kind of a license to create a lot of very electronic, brooding, weird music, which we love. So that's out now on Shudder. And upcoming, one of the more exciting things for us is that we just scored our first TV show. So the Sci-Fi Channel is doing a new zombie show based on Romero's Day of the Dead, called Day of the Dead. And we did the full score for the show. So that'll be out, I think, in October it premieres.
Nice.
So yeah, that was a big one for us. We've had stuff in TV shows before, but we've never been like the composers on a TV show. So that was, very exciting to work and like a shitload of work, honestly. so much music, like 10 45 minute episodes. It was,
wow.
Yeah, it was a lot, but really exciting and something we hope to do more of in the future.
It all sounds awesome. I'll be sure to check the movie out, because again, I have a long weekend. Not a whole lot going on. I can just kind of relax and do some things. And
check out Superhost. Probably not one to watch with the kids. It gets really violent. Spoiler alert, sort of, but it you know, it's a slow burn and then it gets pretty horrifying pretty quick. So
that's some of my favorite stuff. So that's cool. I'll put the kids to bed early and then have a nice, maybe have a drink and just sit down and, you know, be horrified. It'd be great.
That's a good way to do it.
Well, again, you know, I appreciate you coming on. And I guess we'll get out of here. It's my pleasure. I'm always excited to get someone on to talk about something specifically that I'm talking about, instead of just me in my room talking about things that, you know, nobody cares about. So
well, I'm glad you guys like Psycho Goreman, and I'm actually still waiting on my copy of the vinyl. I don't have one here yet, but it should show up soon, and I'm very excited for that.
I got mine about a week ago and it sounds awesome. Like, nice. It's pretty great.
Oh yeah, love it.
All right, man. Well, I will, I appreciate it. And take care. So,
all right. Thanks very much.
All right.
Bye-bye.
All right. So that was my interview with Martin McPhail of Blitz Berlin. I hope you all enjoyed it. I had a blast talking to him. It was a whole lot of fun. And as always, very appreciative when people do come on the show. And yeah, so I have some other kind of surprises in store, some other guests that I will have on in the future for the rest of the Spooktacular. I have a couple of episodes with some pretty cool guests lined up, so be sure to stick around and check out the rest of the month, because it's going to be a lot of fun. With that, again, like I said up top, just you know, watch the movie. It's great. It's on Shudder. It's one of the probably one of the best new horror films I've seen. I say horror, of course, horror, comedy, whatever, you know. It's just, it's really well done, and you will not be disappointed at all. So with all that being said, again, come back next week where, a little preview, I will be discussing 1988's Maniac Cop with my buddy Richie, who you may know from the Super Media Bros podcast. And also, he was on an episode last year with me where we talked about Blink-182's self-titled album 3, which is a whole lot of fun as well. So it should be a good time. So don't miss it. So anyway, the last thing I did want to talk about, or actually, I got a little clip here from one of the songs from the movie that is pretty awesome. So actually, I will let that play me out. So for the Vinyl Countdown, as always, I'm Jeremy Levine. And hope to be in your ears next week. But we're going to get played out by I'm the Heckin' Best.